Okay, a very good evening to you all. My name's Tony Travers from the School of Public Policy and the Department of Government here at the LSE. I'm your chair for this evening, so if you're normally at the LSE, good to see you, and if you're not normally here, welcome. So thank you for coming. And of course, I've got one or two sort of announcements to make before we get into the main part of the evening. The event's being audio recorded. That's one thing to say. The Stephen's book will be available to purchase at the back, and he will sign a copy, should you so desire, at the end, and then there'll be a reception outside as well at the end of the event, which will be at about 8 o'clock. Try to finish on time. I'm also going to announce that LSE Ideas, the excellent LSE Ideas, is going to be launching its summer events program soon, and that there will be some feedback forms handed out at the end of the evening besides. So that's the sort of announcements. Now, the purpose for this evening's event is to celebrate the launch of Sir Stephen Wall's new book. The event's called Chronicle of a Brexit Foretold, Britain and Europe in the Thatcher Era, 1975 to 85. And this is the second, I think I'm right, in the series that you've been involved with. Not the second only book, but second in this series that Stephen's been involved with. And as I often say when we're holding events about Britain and Brexit and the EU, it's been a most unusual week. It's not the first time I've said that, but we're now at a point where it seems that almost every week new chapters will be able to be written about this remarkable saga, and indeed about British constitutional arrangements more generally. So as we speak, the UK's Parliament and Cabinet are involved, or at least they were an hour and a half ago when I last looked, in a standoff about the future of Mrs. May's deal, and the power of each institution is being tested, along with the UK's future relationship with the EU, with all of this as a catalyst. And last night, the legislature voted, in effect, to take control of the executive's management of parliamentary business, that it should come to this. But this is, of course, the end, well, actually the middle of a process which has been in the making since 1945, which has damaged prime ministers and riven parties. And why do I use the past tense here, really? This is a process that's also ongoing. So I'm sure what we're going to do tonight is learn a lot from Stephen and the two respondents about the background to this extraordinary state of affairs. So what we're going to see is first Stephen will introduce his new book, and then there will be responses from Professor Piers Ludlow, my colleague, and from Dr. Lindsay Acqui, whose biographies I will briefly read out in a second. Then we'll have a bit of a discussion up. There'll be a response from them, bit of a discussion up here, and then we'll open it up questions more broadly. Now, first, a couple of words about Stephen and then about the other two, about the two respondents. Sir Stephen Wall was for 35 years a British diplomat. He was private secretary, I'm sure many of you here worked with him, to five British foreign secretaries, worked in number 10 Downing Street for three prime ministers, that's James Callaghan, John Major and Tony Blair, was for 5 years Britain's ambassador to the European Union, and for 4 years Tony Blair's senior advisor on Europe. His earlier book, Europe, A Stranger on Europe, which is called On Europe, A Stranger in Europe, was published in 2008 and was the story of British EU policy under Margaret Thatcher, Tony Blair, John Major and Tony Blair. He's also author of the official history of Britain and the European Community, the first part of it published in 2012. And then our two respondents are Piers Ludlow, Professor of International History and Deputy Head of Department in the Department of International Relations, and Dr. Leslie Aki, who is a Research Associate in the Bennett Institute for Public Policy at the University of Cambridge. But first, I'd like you, ladies and gentlemen, to welcome Sir Stephen Wall.
Well, thanks very much for those of you who've come. It's generous of you. One of the people who helped me with this book and the previous one, and being a sucker for punishment, has volunteered to help me on the one I'm writing at the moment is Jill Bennett, former head of chief historian of the Foreign Office. Before I start talking about Europe, I want to talk about something of which you'll have seen leaflets around here, which is because today is International Epilepsy Awareness Day, and this issue is very close to Jill's heart because her son Dominic, now in his 20s, spent, as did Jill, most of the first 3 years of his life at Great Ormond Street, and is and has been for a long time in a charity called the Meath Epilepsy Charity, founded by the Countess of Meath, who believed that people suffering from epilepsy and similar conditions should not be treated other than as human beings, like other human beings, and enabled to enjoy life to the fullness of, to the fullest possible capacity. And Dominic's condition is very serious, but he has fantastic care and is himself an example of courage and making the most of the life that has been given to him. So it is a very good cause, and if you feel able to give to it, that would be much appreciated. So, on to Europe. I wish my book was actually called Chronicle of a Brexit Foretold, rather than the rather boring title that it actually has. Jill Bennett, whom I mentioned, was kind enough to be both a great source of advice on the earlier book and copy-edited this book. And when she'd read it, she said to me, when you read your book, you think to yourself, it's surprising that we've stayed as long as we have. And I have to say, writing it and revisiting some of the scenes of my life, I rather felt the same thing. As Tony Travers said at the beginning, although there are proximate causes for what happened in the referendum in 2016, the causes actually go back a very long way. They go back into long into British history, to centuries of fighting against Spanish dominance, followed by French dominance under Louis XIV, followed by the dominance of Napoleon in the 19th century, and Germany twice in the last century. But there is a particular post-war issue as regards Britain, which I want to look at and then come on specifically to the Callaghan and Thatcher period, which is covered in my book. And I don't think it's the case that Britain came out of World War II with a sense of hubris, but we were too impoverished by what had happened for that. But we did come out of the war with a clear sense of our place in the world, partly because of the empire, even though it was beginning to undergo the transformation into a commonwealth, partly because we had the relationship we had with the United States, partly because continental Europe was in disarray, partly because we believed in an evolution of the world economic order, which was going to be based on gradual trade liberalization and free trade. And then certain things which were instinctive. In the 1980s, Michael Charlton, who was a BBC Panorama journalist, wrote a very interesting book called The Price of Victory. And he interviewed many of the people, politicians and officials, who were involved in the decisions of the 1950s and early 1960s about Europe. And there is a very, very common thread throughout. And that is that nobody foresaw what was going to happen in continental Europe. Nobody foresaw that a world in which Britain's trade with the Commonwealth was by far its most important trading relationship. Up to the mid-1950s, Britain's largest export market was Australia. Nobody foresaw that transformation. Nobody foresaw the transformation, first of all, through the European Coal and Steel Community, and then later on the failed European Defence Community, and then the success of the European community, that the continental Europe would organize as effectively as it did. They didn't foresee that for the United States, looking at a world in which half of Europe had been overtaken by the Soviet Union, in which the biggest threat to world peace came from the Soviet Union, and in which Germany was at the front line in terms of the risk to world peace, that reintegrating Germany into the structures of the Western nations would be a prime motivator, and that the Americans, while the British were still on one tack, the Americans were on a tack where the evolution of what became a customs union was a high priority for them, and Britain's, and they were prepared to subordinate their own trading interests to that higher political goal. And the thing that comes through very, very, very strongly is that political reactions of British leaders were very, very instinctive. And, for example, if you look at the origins of the coal and steel community, where the words federal Europe as being the goal of the coal and steel community and what might come of it, that use of the word federal produced an instinctive adverse reaction. From that point of view alone, it was not something the Labour government, Foreign Secretary Ernie Bevin, could get engaged with. At the same time, of course, Britain's coal production exceeded that of the rest of Western Europe put together. A Labour government had come into office with a massive program of nationalisation and had just nationalised the coal mines. So apart from instinctive political reactions, from an economic perspective, the idea of putting British coal production under a supranational authority was inconceivable, hence in part Herbert Morrison's famous comment that the Durham miners wouldn't put up with it, wouldn't wear it. That vision of Britain's role changed very slowly. The British official who was sent to the Messina Conference, which gave rise to the Treaty of Rome as an observer, has been traduced by history as walking out saying this will never work and it's all a waste of time. On the contrary, he increasingly realized that this was actually a serious engagement on the part of the six countries seeking to move towards what became the European community, and he was constantly saying so to London. But his advice fell on deaf ears. It simply wasn't taken seriously. And it was only after the advent of the European community, the failed British attempt to create an effective organization in EFTA and to try and make some kind of accommodation with the European community, when that failed, that Britain confronted its European destiny, not as a willing choice, but because of the failure of the strategy that it had undertaken up till now. And a lot of the history of the 1950s is actually of Britain trying to make its intergovernmental view of international order work alongside the more federal view. And it's there from the very beginning. If you look at Churchill's great Zurich speech of September 1946, where he conjures up the United States of Europe, let Europe unite, a Europe that must be built on Franco-German reconciliation, an extraordinarily radical idea at the time. The end of Churchill's speech is about how this will be observed and supported by the United States, hopefully Soviet Russia, and by Britain and the Commonwealth. The story in the book that I've written is the story of after Britain had joined on unfavorable terms, particularly financial terms, because we joined late and had to accept rules that had already been set in place. And after the Labour Party, which was the party which had been preparing to take Britain into government when it lost an election in 1970, the Labour Party in opposition turned against Europe, and Harold Wilson, its leader, could only prevent the Labour Party from adopting a policy of withdrawal from the EEC by offering the prospect of a renegotiation which was to be validated either by a general election or a referendum. And as we know, it was validated by a referendum in 1975, and where the British public voted by two-thirds to stay in. But by the time you get to Wilson's retirement in 1976 and the succession of Jim Callaghan as Prime Minister, you have a situation in which, within months, really, of the referendum, the old arguments within the Labour Party have been revived. much of the Callaghan prime ministership is spent putting out low-level fires arising from the activities of particular cabinet ministers, John Silkin, agriculture minister, and Tony Benn, pursuing their own agenda, hostile to the European community, from within government. Within the Labour Party, the National Executive Committee of the Labour Party during Callaghan's government produced a document which was very close, once again, to recommending withdrawal from the European community. Callaghan, in responding to that, had to frame his response in a way which was basically saying, this is an organisation we can reform from within, which, in domestic political terms, was quite bold, but, of course, in terms of the perception of our partners, was perceived as Britain, despite the referendum result, still being reluctant. The issue of Britain's payments into the European Community budget, one of the issues where we had to accept a Duff deal as the price of accession, an issue which hadn't been resolved by the renegotiation conducted by Harold Wilson, that was beginning to rise to the surface again towards the end of Callaghan's premiership. Indeed, he made a big speech at the Mansion House in 1978 where he said this is a big issue which has got to be resolved. Public opinion, apart from the brief period around the referendum, from the 1950s onwards, was very iffy, and not to say sometimes hostile to membership of the European Community. And Callaghan saw this issue as an issue which would fuel that. The book records a conversation between Jim Callaghan and Prime Minister Karamanlis of Greece when Greece applied to join. And Callaghan asked Karamanlis, why do you want to join? And Karamanlis says, well, we've got a newly restored democracy. We want to be part of this family of democracies. And Callaghan says, I'm sorry to have to tell you that in Britain there is more feeling of warmth towards India than there is any feeling of warmth on the part of the British people towards the rest of Europe. So when Callaghan is defeated in 79 and Margaret Thatcher comes in, this issue of the budget is very close to the top of the agenda. And she addresses it with characteristic vigor and basically saying to our partners that Britain, as one of the poorer members of the European Community in terms of relative prosperity, is, along with Germany, nonetheless, the only net contributor. Everybody else is getting more money back than they put in. Germany is by far the wealthiest country. This cannot go on. She finds it very difficult to get acceptance of that basic thesis because, of course, if Britain is going to pay less, then everybody else is going to have to pay more. And you can argue about the way in which she pursues the case. And in 1980... the conversation, which is worth my giving you a flavour of, between Oliver Wright, our then ambassador in Bonn, and Helmut Schmidt. And Helmut Schmidt was a long-standing friend of Britain, particularly of the Labour leaders, but on a personal level got on well with Margaret Thatcher. And Oliver Wright is giving a dinner for Henry Moore, to which Schmidt comes. And Schmidt takes Oliver Wright on one side, and this is Oliver Wright's report. The Chancellor, Schmidt, then turned to the problems of Britain in Europe. He quite understood our position on the budget. The situation needed remedy. But we should at all costs avoid giving the impression that we were engaged in a second negotiation. Britain's performance in the community to date, since we had joined 7 years ago, had disappointed all her friends, including those closest to us, the Dutch. He thought all our partners had looked forward to Britain's entry to give a new impulse and sense of direction to the community and a new political dimension. But what had happened? We had given little or no impulse to Europe's affairs. We had no vision of what we wanted the community to be. Instead, we had spent 6 years or more haggling like Italians for a little bit here and a little bit there. I paused at an Italian conference I was at before reading out that bit of the sentence, but I thought I would plough on at that conference nonetheless. And the Italians seemed to actually regard it as almost as a compliment. This was no way for a country like Britain to act. What if Britain's contribution did amount to 1 billion? No one could convince him that this was a make-or-break sum and that Britain would be sunk if she did not get it. Compared with our real problems, it was insignificant. And compared with the real problems facing Europe and the world, it was a distraction. Where was our sense of pride? That's Schmitt particularly eloquently, but the view he expressed was a view very common among our partners. But the fact is that Margaret Thatcher spent 5 years trying to get a rebate, which in my view was necessary if there was to be long-term public acceptance of our membership, and only secured it when the community was running out of money and in order to be able to raise more money had to secure her agreement. As to her own attitudes, I think at this stage in her prime ministership, and Charles Pole, who's here, can correct me, I think I read her view as being, on the one hand, profound impatience and anger at what she perceives as an injustice, which it was, profound anger at the Common Fisheries Policy, which had indeed been set up by our partners deliberately before we joined to give them very privileged access to our fishing waters. But her belief in the European Community is a belief in the European Community as a political project essential for democracy and peace in Europe. And there's a speech that she made quite early on in her prime ministership to the Franco-British Council in Bordeaux, and I'll just read a bit of it. Speaking, she said, within a few miles of the birthplace of Jean Monnet, she could say that the European Community was perhaps the most original, practical, political concept to be brought forth by the European genius since the American and French revolutions. Reforms were needed, not least the Common Agricultural Policy, but new initiatives were needed as well. Policies were needed outside agriculture. Europe needed a sound economic base if it was to resume its rightful place as the master of its own destiny and an arbiter of world affairs. The full development of that strength would require the nations of Europe to develop wise, coherent, and mutually beneficial policies. This, in turn, would require understanding and forbearance. And she went on to list the various ways in which the European Community, both in trade and in politics, was a leader in world affairs. But her view, like that of, I would say, every single British Prime Minister involved in this project, from Macmillan, Wilson, Heath as Prime Minister, as opposed to Heath in later life, Heath, the man who took us into Europe, all the evidence of the files has Heath believing very firmly in a Europe run by the British, French, and German governments, with the institutions of the European Community being useful, but in his view, subordinate, the European Commission in particular. So in that sense, Margaret Thatcher is part of a long established tradition, and a tradition which continued in each of her successors up to David Cameron. So in each case, I would argue that these people have realized, accepted, and tried to promote a positive relationship between Britain and her European partners, but they have done so on the basis of a conception of the European Union, which is primarily intergovernmental, more transactional than our partners, and in a sense, if you look at their national interests as opposed to Britain's national interests, for quite a lot of the time, the national interests of countries such as France and Germany, diverging from our own, to the extent that if you look at the original coal and steel community, there was a real French and German interest after the problems of post-World War I and then World War II in putting the means of production of steel and coal in the Ruhr and the Saarland under international control rather than being a source of friction. The prime motivator behind the drive to European Union in Margaret Thatcher's premiership was Helmut Kohl. Helmut Kohl made an interesting speech in Oxford during Margaret Thatcher's prime ministership, which didn't get very much attention at the time, except from Timothy Garden Ash. And Kohl's basic thesis is we need European Union because European Union is the only way in which German reunification can be safely accepted by our partners. Now, at that stage, although German reunification was only a few years away, nobody foresaw it as likely. So I would say we as officials focused on the European Union bit and didn't focus perhaps enough on the kind of national motivation behind it. I won't go on. I've tried to give a kind of flavour of the way in which successive prime ministers, and particularly in this period, wrestled with reconciling the British national interest with a rather different perspective of European development that our partners had. They managed to do it, and we just about managed to do it until 3 years ago. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much for inviting me and for the opportunity to read this book. I thought I would summarize what I thought were five of the kind of key themes or ideas that the book developed and how they maybe link to the title of this and also some of the wider themes of the relationship between Britain and European integration. And the first is something that I think the book brings out really well and connects to the second volume, is the sense, not in Britain, but in Europe, of a lost opportunity in 1975. Many of Britain's partners in the community seem disappointed almost immediately that the United Kingdom doesn't adopt a more constructive or positive posture towards greater European integration. And that sense, I think, comes out quite strongly in the book, and it kind of led me to sort of question where that came from, because certainly that's not the mood within the United Kingdom. The old arguments continue to rage on. The referendum is described in a lot of the literature as being an unenthusiastic vote for the status quo. So the belief in France or Germany that this would settle the European argument, I think, was an unrealistic expectation of the referendum in 1975. The second point that I think comes out quite strongly is the idea that an argument over the budget was inevitable at some point. The Heath government had accepted particular terms during the accession negotiations that it was well known within Westminster would eventually lead Britain to quite a hefty net contribution to the European budget. And there's a real sense in the book that this is not just an argument that begins with Thatcher or is a product of her personality, her own hostility towards European integration, if that's the way you view her, but that actually this is an ongoing argument that has been happening in terms of Britain's period of membership under the Heath government and then during the renegotiation and also under Callaghan's leadership. But there's something particular about the 1980s that means it comes to this massive row that lasts for over 4 years. And I think part of that probably has to do with Thatcher's personality and also the wider economic context, her own domestic economic policies, and this idea of budgetary responsibility that she's trying to instill at home, that being also reflected in her policies in Europe. The third point that I thought was quite interesting and not something that maybe is talked about enough is a question about language. There are a few really kind of interesting anecdotes in the book where Margaret Thatcher receives a memo from the Foreign Office, which recommends that the British start using the phrase European community instead of European economic community or common market. Both terms seem to suggest that the community is just about economics, whereas European community is more all-encompassing. And Thatcher agrees to this, but then says, but I prefer common market. And this is an ongoing argument. The term renegotiation in the 1970s provokes a lot of hostility amongst Wilson's counterparts. The French almost completely refuse to use the term. The Germans refer to it as the so-called renegotiation. So there's a question of you know, why, what is it about the way the British express their views in Europe that leads to confrontation. And I thought that was a sort of a particularly interesting point from the book, that there's a question of language that seems to continually dominate Britain's policy, especially also the way Margaret Thatcher phrases the getting of her money back from Europe, that this is Britain getting, or it's Margaret Thatcher getting her money back. This also provokes a lot of confrontation, the way that the issue is phrased rather than the substance of her request. The fourth point, I think one of the real strengths of the book is that it draws out continuities in Britain's policies towards Europe. And this idea that Britain has been continually trying to make the community more intergovernmental from Macmillan right through to Thatcher, I think is really interesting. And I would kind of agree with that analysis that the British want to move the community away from federalism towards intergovernmentalism. And yet, at every step along the way, they make concessions towards a more integrated and less intergovernmental Europe. In the 1970s, during the renegotiation, Wilson makes concessions on EMU, Economic and Monetary Union, in order to get agreement on certain aspects of his renegotiation. Thatcher similarly has to make compromises over qualified majority voting. So as much as it's kind of the consistent aim of British prime ministers, on the other side, it is also the consistent aim of the community to move towards further integration. And those two aims seem to, often on balance, it seems to be the community that wins in that argument. The final point I want to make is a theme that I was surprised didn't come up as much as I thought it would, and that is sovereignty. I think in the current debate, we can't get away from a discussion about sovereignty, be it national sovereignty or parliamentary sovereignty. In Alan Millward's volume of The Official History, sovereignty is one of these key considerations in the policies of Britain towards the European coal and steel community right through to the first application. I mean, if you look at the debates in the 1970s around the renegotiation, this is one of the key demands of the anti-marketeers that Britain's parliamentary sovereignty be somehow safeguarded in Europe. And in the government's own propaganda ahead of the referendum, pages are devoted to the fact that the government's renegotiation now protects Britain's sovereignty. And I was really struck by the fact that language about sovereignty, although it appears later, definitely in the Bruges speech that Thatcher gives towards the end of the 80s, but it doesn't seem to be as prevalent in the early period of the 1980s. It seems as though the British are kind of moving away from arguing about sovereignty in this period. And instead, even in the debates about the Luxembourg Compromise and whether or not governments should be allowed the so-called veto over policy, Thatcher doesn't frame it as an issue of national sovereignty. Instead, she frames it as an issue of that being the kind of community Britain entered, that Britain enters on the promise that there is a national veto to protect the national interest. And I think it's really interesting how the debate kind of shifts away from sovereignty and more to a debate about the deal that Britain accepted in the 1970s and how that deal should evolve. So I think I will leave it there. Those are what I think the kind of five big things that really come out of the book. And I might just sort of link it back to this title about the chronicle of a Brexit foretold. I think it's very tempting to see this as kind of a very long, slow march from 1975 towards the vote for Brexit in 2016. But there are elements of engagement as well, and it's not as though Thatcher, certainly it comes out quite strongly in the book, that it's not as though Thatcher sort of continually threatened to withdraw. She made attempts at engagement. At least that's the sense I get from this early period.
Well, first of all, thank you also to the organisers for involving me. It was a pleasure to read the book, but not least because it's such an incredibly rich period. This is a book that goes from the aftermath of the referendum through to the Single European Act, but it's punctuated the whole way through with episodes that I'm old enough to dimly remember, but have not yet had a chance to look at in the files at the National Archives. So this was an excellent way of forcing me to re-engage with these subjects. Now, I think in a book that is so long and in the 10 minutes that I promised to limit myself to, it would be crazy to try and summarize or sort of engage in a very strong overarching argument. So along similar lines to what Lindsay has just done, what I thought I'd do was pick out a few conclusions that I draw from my first take on this. It's a book I will doubtless come back to, so my conclusions will probably evolve. But I've identified five things that struck me looking back at my reading of it. The first, and this links with things that both Sir Stephen himself and Lindsay have picked up on, is the extent to which the first referendum really doesn't seem to change very much at all. It is a seemingly decisive outcome, and there is, therefore, in the immediate aftermath, both on continental Europe but also within Britain, a certain amount of discussion about how this has settled the question once and for all. And yet, within months, certainly within years, the British find themselves engaged in a similar pitched battle internally about the very question of community membership that the referendum had purportedly settled, and they find themselves at the level of governmental policy incapacitated by those internal decisions. After all, it's only 3 years after the referendum that the Labour government of Callaghan will take the decision not to participate in the European monetary system, which was the most ambitious and bold European initiative of the 1970s. The British, in a sense, took the first opt-out decision very shortly after the referendum. And it does, therefore, again, with the link to Brexit, make me wonder what on earth Cameron was thinking in 2016 in the belief that a referendum, which was very unlikely under any stretch of the imagination to produce as decisive a result in 2016 as it had done in 1975. The idea that this would shut up the ultras in the Conservative Party for very long was misguided thinking if ever I saw it. So that would be the first conclusion. The second conclusion would be, and this was a surprise, was the extent to which enlargement does not really come out as a British priority during much of this period. It's become one of the clichés of discussions about European integration that the British have always been great fans of enlargement. Sometimes cynical continental observers have suggested that this is because it would dilute the community and widening would get in the way of deepening. But actually what struck me about reading this volume is how the Greek membership and membership of Spain and Portugal, but particularly Spain, were discussed in really pretty cagey terms through much of this time. The British certainly didn't oppose them in an outright fashion. There was no attempt to emulate General de Gaulle or even Giscard d'Estaing in public opposition to community enlargement. But the lack of enthusiasm for Greek membership, the lack of enthusiasm about Spanish membership, is, I think, one of the more striking features of the volume, and one that did grab me and makes me think, as somebody who has periodically written about the whole enlargement story within the community, history and development, it does make me reassess somewhat the role of the British within that story. It was certainly not a British priority during these years, even if it wasn't something the British were absolutely opposed to. Third conclusion, and again this was something that came as a surprise, and I genuinely did learn from reading this volume, was the extent to which, I would argue, Mrs. Thatcher learns from the bruising nature of her first round of engagement over the British budgetary dispute, or the BBQ, the British budgetary question, or the bloody British question, according to Roy Jenkins. I'd worked to a certain extent, because I'd written about Roy Jenkins' presidency, on round one of the engagement, so 1979 until the deal of May 1980. And the thing that is very striking about that is the sort of no-holds-barred, very confrontational nature of the dispute at that point in time, with a succession of the European Council meetings dominated by the row. What's interesting to me reading this volume is to realise the extent to which subsequent confrontations, although certainly disruptive and certainly at times fairly bitter, were nevertheless conducted in a somewhat more circumspect fashion, which I do think suggests that Mrs. Thatcher herself had learnt in part from the first round of confrontation. Now, there were other factors, of course. One of the first points on which the budget row revives after the 1980 temporary truce is in 1982, when, of course, the British find themselves engaged in a real war in the Falklands, and a war during which they need some degree of community solidarity and support. And therefore, as the book points out, this was not a moment for Britain to enter into a whole no-holds-barred dispute with its partners. So that may have been one factor in 1982, at least. I suspect Geoffrey Howe's shift from the Treasury, where he had been a fairly vociferous campaigner for a hard line, to the Foreign Office, where he took a much more diplomatic approach, is also probably significant in changing the tone. And a third factor, I suspect, is the influence, although there are many present who would probably comment on this more than I could, of certain key advisers, notably, I suspect, David Williamson, in changing the tone. But I do think it Mrs. Thatcher herself learns quite a lot about the best manner in which to engage. And I'm actually struck by the manner in which, in particular, the interaction with Helmut Kohl is much more civil, much more friendly. Well, friendly is perhaps putting it a bit too strongly, but certainly much more unantagonistic than later legend would have of it. The two were not close, and a lot of the conversations and correspondence between them remains very formal. But actually, they're very constructive in their early engagement over the budgetary issue. And therefore, I do think this reflects a realization on the part of Mrs. Thatcher that in order to get a budgetary settlement, she needs to have the French and Germans, but particularly the Germans, on her side, rather than the confrontational approach she'd adopted in the first instance. Fourth conclusion, staying on the budgetary theme, is the degree to which, and this is something that comes up very strongly from the book, the British budgetary question was part and parcel of a much bigger and wider European community-wide budgetary problem. Now, in a sense, the experts know about this, and it's something that I mention on the regular class that I give about this, but it's not something that a lot of the literature gives a great deal of emphasis to. And yet I do think this book brings out very clearly that you can't really understand either the reception of Britain's ideas on the budget or the eventual solution to the budgetary problem without realising the links between the British budgetary problem and the wider problem that the community as a whole was running out of money as the 1980s progressed, because the own resources, in other words, the money that accrued automatically to the community, was essentially static, whereas the expenditure, particularly on the CAP, was anything but, and therefore the amount of money available was ever shrinking. Now, it does strike me that if you understand that, both the flaws in some of the early British tactics and the nature of the solution arrived at become much clearer. So as far as the flaws in the early tactics are concerned, I do think the British made a mistake initially in assuming too easily that Germany would automatically be on their side as the other major net contributor. And I think that was a mistake for two reasons. Firstly, because the Germans were aware that if the British paid less, they were likely to have to pay more. So they had a financial incentive to not disrupt this. But also because the reason the community was running into budgetary difficulty was CAP expenditure. And the level of CAP expenditure was deeply linked to the level of agricultural prices that the Germans themselves insisted upon. The biggest advocate of high agricultural prices within the community were not the French or the Dutch, they were the Germans. And therefore, the idea that the Germans would be a good ally on this issue was initially, at least, somewhat flawed. It was also the case that the initial British attempt to link agricultural prices and the budget rebate was deeply flawed, because the countries that did well out of the existing financial regime would be doubly hurt by any change. They would be hurt by the of diminution of the British contribution, but they would also be hurt by any reduction in CAP expenditure, as they were the principal beneficiaries of it. And yes, there was a linkage that could be made, and in a sense both were facets of the same problem, but the tactics were wrong to combine the two. The breakthrough comes, however, when you move into the mid-1980s and you start really reaching a situation where a new overall settlement of the budget needs to be reached if the community is to persist in its operation at all. Because at that point, Britain has to be part of the solution, because no new financial arrangement can be reached other than by unanimity. And that then sort of Britain's collaboration in an overall solution becomes the crucial key for unlocking the Fontainebleau deal. Now, it's often forgotten that Fontainebleau doesn't just reach an agreement on the British rebate. It also reaches an agreement on a wider lifting of the community budget ceiling. And the need for unanimity on that gave the British a bargaining position they had never previously had. And so I do think the whole sort of our whole interpretation of the British budgetary problem needs to be kind of rethought slightly in connection with the wider budgetary dispute. Finally, I'm also, my final observation would be the extent to which I'm very struck by the relative slowness with which a British positive view of the European community in terms of policy, not in terms of general spirit, emerges, but also the force with which it emerges when it finally does. The problem that the British have in the community in many of the early years covered by this volume is in a sense that they're complaining at too many levels all at once. They don't like the budget, they don't like the CAP, they don't like the common fisheries policy, they don't like direct elections to the European Parliament, they can't join the European monetary system. It ends up with a sort of constant series of negative comments that the occasional speech, and Sir Stephen quoted it from a couple which sort of it goes heavy on the European idealism, can't really compensate. There's not enough positive engagement. From about 1983 onwards, however, and it probably is no coincidence that this happens to coincide with the moment when Geoffrey Howe moves to the Foreign Office, you start getting a much more systematic emergence of what will become the big British cause in Europe, which is the pushing of the internal market and declaring war on non-tariff barriers. And once that positive vision emerges, then the British engagement with the process can be much, much more wholehearted. And the fact that you continue to squabble about the budget, you continue to complain about fish, is in a sense compensated for by this much more positive agenda that begins to emerge and will subsequently be confirmed by the Europe the Future document, which was also distributed at Fontainebleau, and of course by the actions of Lord Cofield as the one of the two British commissioners in the Delors Commission. So I think that emergence of a positive British agenda is one of the crucial contributions, also the tracking of it is one of the crucial contributions of this volume. But to end on a point that Lindsay also touched upon it, this is an emergence that comes at a cost too. Because I think by the time you get to the final chapter of the volume covering 1985, the British determination to secure that agenda means that they are prepared to accept a number of concessions on the institutional level and really to move rather a long way in their attitudes towards the Single European Act. Because they see this as a mechanism for getting the single market. Now, they were right in that you wouldn't have been able to get the single market almost certainly without institutional change. And in a way, it was good in the short term that this sugared the pill, but of course, of swallowing institutional change. But of course, these institutional changes were institutional changes which did not stop with the delivery of the single market, but had ramifications and implications that were to continue deep into the following decades and would ultimately perhaps contribute to the situation we're now in. But I'll finish there. Thank you.
Okay, well, first, thank you all. Before I open this up to the audience, and I realize there are a number of people here who will know a great deal about this subject historically. I just, listening to the three of you, first Stephen speaking and the two respondents, the first thing that comes to mind is that a picture emerges of a slightly distant, at least from the popular image of Margaret Thatcher, as somebody who's pragmatic. We know that she could be pragmatic, flexible, willing to change, businesslike, tough, and presumably at the time, particularly in the early 80s, witnessing a change in the UK economy that she was willing to bring about, which were presumably new markets and a changed financial position for Britain, would also have been a very attractive proposition. So I wonder, is that characterization of her, as I've just sort of described it there, is that sort of reasonable, Stephen?
I wouldn't go too heavy on the flexibility.
willing to change, I slightly qualified it.
The reason I subtitled the book, The Tiger Unleashed, John Fretwell, who was a senior foreign office official in his oral history after retirement, said that, for a start, after a Labour government which was lukewarm, if not hostile to Europe, the expectation was that a Conservative government, the Conservative Party is the party of Europe, would be much more positive. And Fretwell says, Margaret Thatcher said, we'd expected change. What we had not realised is that there would be a tiger unleashed. And very early on, and this is a pretty good example of a style which Whitehall was not accustomed to, Carrington, as Foreign Secretary, holds a meeting with Peter Walker, the Fisheries Minister, about the handling of the Common Fisheries Policy, and he minutes Margaret Thatcher. And her handwriting is there. We agreed, writes Carrington, that our negotiating leverage on this issue is likely only to deteriorate as time goes by. Thatcher, no. I therefore firmly endorse Peter Walker's recommendation that we should seek a settlement on the Common Fisheries Policy within the next few months. No. If you can agree to an approach along the lines of Peter Walker's minute, no. I would propose that he gives Mr. Gundelach, who's the Commissioner for Fisheries, an indication of the way we are thinking. No. Carrington concludes, we must remember our pledges. Yes, they are contrary to everything in this minute. And that's, I mean, you know, Charles will vouch for this. This is par for the course. This is the normal discourse.
I think that in particular, her marginalia on various minutes, it really gives you a sense not only of her personality, but also the way that she communicates. She's direct, kind of in the extreme. There's no additional qualification, just no, no, no. The only thing I would add to your characterization of her was this, throughout the book, there are these constant kind of periods of optimism where it seems that Anglo-German or Anglo-French or the combination of all three, that the relationship between these countries is improving. There's been a positive summit between the two leaders, or between all three. And then very quickly afterwards, that seems to dissipate. And largely that has to do with Thatcher's assessment after the fact. So I think, yeah, I would agree that we shouldn't emphasize the cooperation or flexibility too much.
I agree, obviously, about the confrontational language and the notes. I think the only rider I'd add to that is actually, if you then look at the policy over the next 2 years, you may discover that actually it shifts in the direction of the original note. This, after all, became the Brussels cliche about Thatcher by the end of her presidency. That's a Freudian slip there, but by the end of her stint as prime minister, sort of that she would say no, 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 but at 3 a.m. she would give in. Now, there is an element of that already here. There are a whole series of very strong positions adopted over a whole succession of issues where actually, if you look at where Britain is 3 months, 6 months, a year down the line, the position hasn't been maintained absolutely. Now, of course, you could argue that Britain still concedes less than it would have done if there'd been a less forceful prime minister. So I'm not necessarily saying this doesn't matter historically, but I do think we have to kind of counterbalance the immediate reaction of the forceful no and where diplomacy eventually leads.
And there's a sense that you'd know, I mean, I'm not drawing any contemporary parallels, but there is a sense you'd know where you were, even if she changed her position. And there was you've just read out, Stephen, a very clear statement that I'm assuming civil servants, her colleagues, would have known what she thought on issues, and they could go and report back and do diplomacy.
Yeah, and I think that's, I mean, if you come roll forward to the negotiations on the single European Act, that is very clear. Yes, there were compromises, but the things that were, as it were, red lines were for her were very, 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 very clear. And I think she, I mean, setting aside the argument about our handling of the rebate negotiation, I think the biggest achievement was that she said right from the beginning, this cannot be settled with a series of ad hoc deals. There has to be a long-term solution that lasts for as long as the problem. And she absolutely stuck by that. There's a bit of French revisionism, which is reflected in some of the things that Charles Moore reports in his biography of the French. I say, well, she could have had a much better deal much earlier. Well, she had to make some compromise on the amounts, but she was fighting the battle of an enduring settlement right up to the last minute, and she got a lasting settlement that is still applies to this day. And that was not something anybody on the continent at the beginning or even till the very end readily accepted.
Okay. Right, let's open it. I know there's others who have experience of this world in the audience and may want to add something or a bit of revisionism of their own or to agree. So we have microphones. So would anybody like to either ask a question of Stephen or the other two panelists or, you know, add something? Right, two questions at the front here. And if you'd like to, say who you are, but don't think you've got to.
David Haney, I lived through a good deal of this. Stephen, in his first book about Stranger in Europe, did describe a lot of that. Just two things. One, Stephen, you went over at the beginning of your presentation, I thought quite rightly, the sort of discrepancies between the way the British approached these European issues and the rest of Europe did so. But one thing you didn't mention is something that's always bulked very high in my analysis, which is the real difference was that the experience of the first half of the 20th century had vindicated Britain's national institutions. They had come through an appalling series of experiences, but they had come through intact. We thought, of course, they'd come through undamaged, which was not quite the same thing. But they come through intact, whereas everyone else in the rest of the continent either produced fascist regimes that destroyed their national institutions, or alternatively, they've been conquered and their national institutions have been subverted and destroyed by the external invader. And that went for Eastern Europe as well. And I do think that that fault line is really absolutely fundamental. Because you cannot wish it away. You cannot hope that it will be different. It's there. And I wonder whether you could just comment on that. The other thing about the early period was it did strike me how fascinating it is that the British always think they know more about the American policy than the Americans do. So we made a fundamental mistake in the 1950s, failing to understand that European integration was a major American national interest. And then we did it all over again when the unification of Germany came along. And at the end, beyond your period, Mrs. Thatcher took a line about that, and she simply didn't seem to notice that the Americans were heading in exactly the opposite direction.
I think your comment on the institution is absolutely right. And I think one of the things that comes through, clearly less from these documents, but certainly comes through very clearly in Michael Charlton's book and the evidence of people at the time, is this feeling of, doubt that the six countries can actually kind of get their act together. Not least because, I mean, certainly with the French Fourth Republic, governments falling on a regular basis, very large communist parties in the French Parliament and in the Italian Parliament, and therefore that kind of sense of, well, kind of fundamental unreliability as compared with the British institutions is certainly there. But the other feature of Bevin's fury, really, when, as he puts it, Britain is treated as just another country for the purposes of martial aid, i.e. just what it says. But it's interesting the extent to which the British persist in the belief that somehow they are always going to be treated differently and more preferentially by the Americans.
And to pick up the point David Haney makes about the in a sense that, I think if I've got this right, that the way in which Britain had survived, these intact institutions and the belief in them as almost immortal, not my word, sort of led to the clouding of judgment. I mean, is that going too far? I think it led to decisions being made by the British political class that perhaps even today still are clouded.
To an extent, I think that, I mean, the other factor, of course, is, I mean, which we see obviously written, up in huge letters at the moment, is just the straight issue of domestic politics. Jill Bennett's book, Six Moments of Crisis, brings this out very clearly in the run up to the decision to apply for membership. One of the biggest obstacles to the British government taking a decision is their concerns about the Commonwealth and the consultation of the Commonwealth, the special Commonwealth summit. How is this going to be managed? How are we going to be able to negotiate for preferential Commonwealth access? Which is why instead of Macmillan launching a wholehearted application to join, it's rather tentative. We will explore whether we can actually reach an agreement. And of course, and de Gaulle kind of latches onto this in a way, and from the very beginning, de Gaulle is saying, well, you know, we've got the common market, you've got the Commonwealth, and kind of ne'er the twain shall meet.
Okay, I'll come back to two of you in a second. Let's take another question. And anybody else who'd like to put up a hat and a sign can come. Yeah.
Hi, so Daniel Furby. I did my doctoral research on British entry. I've been working in Brussels for several years now, and now I teach in Athens. So I just want to pick up on this conversation, actually, slightly, because to me it sounds a little bit British, because we sort of, I don't disagree that British survival of its institutions during the war had a profound effect on national psychology, but we always run the risk of presenting sort of a typical continental view on Europe, which in my experience, and Professor Ludlow may also want to pick up on, I don't recognize. I mean, when you look at other national attitudes towards the European project, there's a lot of divergence. Can depend on who the leaders are. So, Stephen, you picked it up in your comments on coal. There's a strong national agenda there too. So I think we have to think, what are we really comparing Britain to? Britain is an outlier, clearly, but where does it really distinguish from where the other member states are? I think that's an important point to get right, that, you know, what is it that's actually different about Britain? And so that's just a problem statement. A sort of question is, my research was on British entry, and the main argument I've always seen in the entry period is politics primarily. Economics is important, but it's politics in the sense of Britain's place in the world. And what was so striking about 2016 is that the debate around Britain's place in the world really was not part of the central debate on why Britain is a member of the European Union. And just in your work on the decade and also after entry, does that sort of perspective on why Britain entered start to diminish? When can we start to see that sort of ebbing? Does it ebb, or is it always there in British government? So just some thoughts.
All right, on the other two, yes, I mean, Lindsay, do you want to?
I think you're absolutely right to point out the kind of Anglocentrism of a lot of the kind of awkward partner type theses. So the most well known thesis, the awkward partner thesis, the idea that Britain is somehow fundamentally unsuited culturally, economically, politically, even historically, geographically, to membership of the European community suggests that Britain is an outlier, and that's true to an extent. But I think you also can't discount the fact that the other member states defend their national interests just as strongly as the British do. I don't think anybody could doubt that the French are willing to defend to the very end the common agricultural policy in just as strongly. It just seems that the French are better at wrapping that in communautaire terminology. They're somewhat better at doing that than the British are. I think also it's worth pointing out that the argument that there was a price of victory in 1945, and that this kind of clouded judgment in 1950, there is something to that, and that is part of the reason why the British reject the invitation to join the coal and steel community. But also, you know, the British were not the crucial country to be involved in that coal and steel community. This was primarily a Franco-German arrangement. Germany is the only country that's mentioned by name in the Schuman Plan. And so I think you're absolutely right that we have to place this kind of British exceptionalism within a much bigger context of the wider European integration project that Britain is somehow awkward or exceptional from. I don't think I won't comment on your final point.
Which is very convenient because I was going to. No, in fact, it's particularly convenient, and we didn't plan this in advance, but had I had a sixth point, it would have been actually the surprisingly sort of low level of attention you pay to the whole sort of European political cooperation dimension. It's there in the margins. It periodically comes up. You talk a little bit about the Falklands War. You talk a little bit about sort of attitudes towards Poland and the what's sometimes called the Second Cold War in the early 1980s. And it comes out over one of the reasons why the Milan summit of 1985 was so bruising, because various British ideas about political cooperation had seemingly been appropriated by the Germans and the French. I didn't read nearly as much as I would have expected. So, for instance, one of the arguments that one of my current PhD students is developing is that one of the ways in which you can interpret the British line towards the Venice Declaration in, 1980 or 1981 about, reconfiguring the European stance on the Middle Eastern issue and on the Arab-Israeli conflict. One of the reasons why the British are very keen to push towards a European sort of statement on that and advance towards a European role in the Middle East is precisely to demonstrate that at a time where the British are picking fights about the community budget, they can still be good Europeans and they can have a role there. Now, that is the evidence that my PhD student is currently presenting me with, to my eyes, looks quite convincing, but you don't really say very much about that,
that's probably the fault of my deformation professionnelle as having been a more of a community but it's there in tooth. I mean, the argument that you make of Britain wanting to demonstrate that it does have a positive agenda, it's very clear in the document Europe the Future, which Margaret Thatcher gave to her colleagues at the Fontainebleau Summit in 1984, which is the text which is at the back of the book, and obviously she didn't herself write it, but she approved every word of it. When I was working for Tony Blair and the Tories were attacking him on his European defence policies, he read out a chunk of it and was loudly booed until he revealed the name of the author, at which point there was rather a lot of silence on the Tory opposition benches. And you mentioned the document, which was really the first document putting foreign policy cooperation in legal terms, which was the document that was indeed appropriated by the French and Germans in a pretty scandalous way. And I think, you know, if there was something that contributed to Margaret Thatcher's attitude, I mean, if you as the British Prime Minister make a point of sending a document in confidence to the President of France and the Chancellor of Germany and asking for their views before you circulate it more widely, you remind them of it via your ambassadors, and the first thing you hear about it is when it is published by the French and Germans, topped and tailed and presented as a treaty of their own. It is pretty scandalous. The sort of thing, as you said at the time, that would get you expelled from a London club. But it was, if you look at Geoffrey Howe's memoirs, in Britain 10 years after the event, it still rankles with him very strongly. It comes through very clearly.
Okay, good. Right. Now, another question in the front row here. Questions at the back and the sides, also welcome.
Thank you very much. David Manning. I'd like to ask Stephen if he'd follow up on David Hannay's second question, which is about the attitude of these prime ministers to United States and what they said or didn't say about their European views and about the role that we had in Europe in their conversations with their American counterparts, and just how much they took the sort of the special relationship into account in thinking about Britain's role in Europe.
If you go back to the period before this volume. Macmillan very, very clearly, as his own thinking is evolving about the fact that Britain has to confront the reality of the European community uses Kennedy as a vehicle, as the incoming president, and uses Kennedy's attitude, which I don't think arises instinctively in Kennedy, but that's what his advisers tell him, that Britain joining the European community is very important, partly for the earlier reasons we've talked about, partly because France under de Gaulle is being regarded by the States as a pain in the ass, and Britain joining maybe will corral it. That comes through very clearly. In this period, the thing I think that is most striking to me in that context is Jim Callaghan and the whole episode of the exchange rate mechanism, because Schmidt tells two people of his idea to create a European exchange rate mechanism, which is partly driven by frustration at US economic policies at the time, and he wants Britain to be a founder member. Part of Jim Callaghan's reaction is that this is constructed in the German interest, not the British interest, and it will drive a coach and horses through his anti-inflation policy, which was critical, of course, at that time to trying to rescue the British economy, and he won't get it through the Labour Party. But the other part of it is Callaghan in the run-up to a G7 summit creating a British economic growth strategy, which he takes to the United States and sells rather successfully to Carter. And as you know, Callaghan worked very, very hard on his relationship with Carter. And it's rather a traditional British view as well as particular to the time. A Callaghan view that if you're simply focusing on Europe, you lose the wider picture and you lose the Americans. Now again, rather to the British surprise, Carter actually rather likes the Schmidt approach, which kind of pulls the rug from under our feet. That's the most prominent example I can think of from the period.
Hi, my name is Nick Royal. I'm just here as an observer, and I suppose my question would be, how much Euroscepticism did Margaret Thatcher face from her back benches between 79 and 83 when her majority wasn't so big, and whether that had any effects on her thinking?
There's a point where Callaghan, as Prime Minister, is told by one of his party advisers that he needs to watch the kind of sceptical flank, because Margaret Thatcher, as leader of the opposition, is as it were, playing to that flank within her own party. When Callaghan decides not to take Britain into the exchange rate mechanism, the Conservative opposition are very critical, but privately, actually, of the same view. This was not something that Britain should be doing. I mean, it's a factor, I think, in the background. A relatively, I would, from the evidence I saw, a relatively small factor at that point. But I mean, it is, you know, the other historical evidence, self-evidently, is that it's a trend in the Conservative Party from the word go. Very evident, of course, in Heath's. When Heath is negotiating and wants to get the approval of the House of Commons for Britain joining the European community and only gets his vote in the House of Commons with the support of Labour rebels, and in the world in which we then lived before the world of fixed-term parliaments, regards that vote as an issue of confidence and goes down to the House with a bit of paper in his pocket written for him by his private secretary, Robert Armstrong, which is the announcement of a general election. As this being an issue of competence, had he lost, and his main worry was not just the position of the Labour Party, but those rebels within his own ranks. Francis Pym, who was the chief whip, very cleverly calculated that if Heath ran a three-line whip or gave a free vote, he would get exactly the same result in terms of the number of rebels. And giving the Tory party a free vote was one of the, while Labour maintained its three-line whip, I think it was one of the things that actually empowered the Labour rebels to do what they did and get Heath's victory. So that trend is clearly there. And one of the things that does come through a lot in the Thatcher period is her constant worry
about reopening issues within the Conservative Party. That's one of her main reactions when Britain is voted, invokes the Luxembourg Compromise, the so-called veto to try and defeat an agricultural settlement, and is voted down. One of her main reactions is this will reopen the whole issue of Europe within the Conservative Party.
Yes. Just on that, though, so I think it is worth stressing, though, that the fact that for quite a lot of the period in question, particularly, obviously, the 1983 general election, the Labour Party is so clearly positioned as the Eurosceptic party, does sort of, just by the logic of party competition, push the Conservative Party into a more clearly pro-European position than perhaps the instincts of some backbenchers would suggest. So I think there is a... It's not a theme that comes out strongly from the volume, I suspect not because you've ignored it, but because it's not a theme of the period. I think if you'd gone on and done the next 4 years, I suspect you'd find the Conservative Party backbench Euroscepticism became a much bigger issue.
But there is a sort of sense here, and I know going backwards and forwards from this period, of almost as if there's a fixed amount of Euroscepticism within the political system at any one time. It just gets passed around in different bits. Even you're describing it, Stephen, when Ted Heath finally gets his legislation through, the way you put it doesn't sound that dissimilar to some of the things that are going on out there almost as we speak.
No, I think, I mean, my own feeling is that the seminal change was Margaret Thatcher's evolving views of the European community towards the end of her prime ministership, her opposition to the Maastricht Treaty. Although had she remained prime minister, I think it's quite possible she would have done exactly what her successor did in terms of the opt-out, because the advice available to her was that if Britain vetoed a European treaty, those other countries of the European community who wanted to go ahead with a single currency would have made a separate legal agreement to do so. But I think Margaret Thatcher then setting herself up in opposition to the Maastricht Treaty in the House of Lords, and a lot of conservatives, including people like David Cameron, as it were, sitting at her feet, and opposition to Europe becoming synonymous with loyalty to the fallen leader. I think that is a sort of seismic shift in the politics of it.
Okay. Yes. Two.
Hi there. Alex Braley, FCO Europe Research Analyst. Just two quick questions, if I may. We've talked a lot about how France, Germany, other member states influence thinking in this period. And also domestic politics. I don't know if the book touches upon, or you can say a few words about how, firstly, the EU institutions themselves might have helped shape or develop UK thinking, with the Parliament becoming elected for the first time in 1979, so the government's interactions with the institutions, how that sort of affected how the EU was perceived in development. And secondly, a lot has been made out in sort of the last years about the role of the media. And it just struck me that wasn't mentioned at all. And I don't know if you can say a few words about what influence that had at the time, particularly with the rise of the Sun in the last 20 years and some of the headlines they've been putting up.
Okay, let's take the other. I'm going to have one female speaker before the end of the evening. I'm feeling slightly, if there's any female question who'd like to make a statement or put us, I'd love to hear from you. Yes. Yeah, yes.
So my name is Stuart Smedley. I'm a PhD student over at King's College. Question in regards to the public relations element of Britain's European policy at this time. Obviously, the British budgetary question had led to quite a confrontational kind of portrayal of Britain's relations with Europe in the early 1980s. But to what extent was there a discussion regarding the need to sell the vision that was encapsulated in Europe the Future and the desire for the internal market programme to be completed? To what extent was there a desire to sell that vision to the British public?
Email question? Statement? Just one? It would be good to have one at the end of the evening, please. We'll put pressure on people. Okay, right. Let's take
on the European Parliament. I mean, the early part of the book, I mean, Wilson saying immediately after the referendum, this settles the issue of British membership of the European Parliament. We have as a country, we've decided to stay in the European community. We must now take our place in the European Parliament. But that being very much a controversial issue and continuing controversial issue into the Callaghan prime ministership within the Labour Party, and Callaghan and David Owen as Foreign Secretary devoting a huge amount of time and ingenuity and backwards and forwards with the Liberal Party about getting the conditions in which agreement can actually be reached in Parliament, with the support of Labour MPs for British MEPs to take their seats. I think it's some time before the European Parliament starts to bulk large in UK government thinking. I mean, the procedures are established quite early on as to how British officials are going to interact with the European Parliament, etc. But it's really, I think, you've got to go really, I think, to the 1990s before that really develops, and I think it takes off in a big way after the dismissal of the Santé Commission and the Parliament's role as really the most important institution, certainly more important than the Commission in terms of the exercise of power. At that stage, I mean, I think, and speaking from my own experience, and whether others would agree or not, that our thinking was much more directed to the European Commission than it was to the European Parliament. And in terms of Margaret Thatcher's views in particular, her views, as you know, evolved. She was a strong supporter of Delors' appointment as President of the Commission. She admired what he had done as French finance minister in terms of correcting the economic policies initially pursued by President Mitterrand. And she supported him for a second term. That went badly wrong by the end of the 80s. On the media, I mean, as you know, at the time of the 75 referendum, most of the British media, including, as I'm very fond of pointing out, the Times newspaper, whose editor, William Rees-Mogg, was passionate pro-European at that stage, the bulk of the British media was very, very strongly in favour of a positive vote, Daily Express and the Communist Morning Star being the notable exceptions. I think that partly, of course, because the period when Margaret Thatcher's negotiating on the rebate also coincides with a period when her own domestic policies are at their most controversial and unpopular. So using the skills of Bernard Ingham, notably, to kind of stir this up as an issue of kind of national patriotism, that is very strong. And I think the kind of combative element in Britain's relation with the European community, that this is a kind of 100 years war by other means, does begin to take hold at that point. On the single market, finally, and was there an effort to sell this to the British public? Yes. I mean, David Young, Lord Young, who was then the Secretary of State for Trade, spent a large part of his budget after the negotiation of the Single European Act, to the fury of the Treasury, on mounting a television advertising campaign, which ran for 3 months. And public awareness of the single market at the start of the campaign was 3%, and it went up to something over 90% by the end of the campaign. So it was targeted mainly on business, but it was advertisements on commercial television. So it was seen by a very large audience. And interestingly, British popular support for the European community went up to somewhere in the mid-60s, which I don't think was ever as high after that, which does actually show, if you mount a kind of propaganda exercise skillfully enough, you can actually change public opinion. That was pretty much the last time it was done. In the Foreign Office, Michael will remember this, we had various attempts at various times to produce sort of pro-European propaganda documents. There was even a very clever young guy who worked in, when I was head of the European Department, called Anthony Carey, who later went on to work in the Commission and had a distinguished career. And Anthony's idea was to use page 3 of The Sun, then notorious for the photographs that appeared on that page, to use page 3 to promote a pro-European stance. His submission to that effect went as far as then Under Secretary One David Hannay, at which point it was wisely consigned to consigned to the dustbin of history.
Very good.
So I might address the second and third questions about the media and public relations. So I think there's quite an interesting, it's obviously a very interesting moment in 1975 where the majority of the British press is backing a yes vote. And even papers that in 1973 had been hostile to entry to the community changed their mind and are in favour of a yes vote in 1975. And I think one of the things that seems to happen kind of from my reading of the book in the 1980s is that there's a lot of concern on Margaret Thatcher's part and some of her advisors that the budget deal is one of the main things kind of holding British public opinion back from taking a more positive view on Europe. And perhaps I missed it, but there's seems to me there were kind of two opportunities to sort of sell the European project in the early 1980s, the 10-year anniversary of British accession and the 10-year anniversary of the referendum. And I'm not sure that there was a kind of a big public relations push or a big kind of information campaign on the part of the government to celebrate that or to sort of discuss that alongside the development of Britain's policies in Europe with the public, although there had definitely been kind of concerted efforts to sell the European project in earlier periods.
There was a 10-year anniversary document that was produced, but I mean its circulation would have been minimal by modern standards. Okay.
So it managed not to produce a coin that could never be used. There is that. Piers.
Just very quickly on the institutional thing. So one of the things that strikes me very much, and this is in a sense expected, but this book confirms, is that this is very much a big country view of the community. So France and Germany loom very large, the others much less so than periodic walk on parts for the Italians and whoever held the rotating presidency, and sometimes the Greeks as annoyances, but not really, there's not very much of the smaller member states. And there's relatively little about the institutions, but I think the big thing that I would take out from reading this is the difference in a sense in the British diagnosis of what is wrong with the community in the early 1980s and the prevailing diagnosis elsewhere elsewhere in Europe. So in Britain, there's an obvious fixation on the budgetary problem, but this is coupled with a belief that some of the policy priorities are seriously skewed, notably on agriculture and fish, and as I said in my intervention from the podium, sort of by the 83, 84 at least, a growing realization that a big push is needed on the internal market. On the continental side, there's much more fixation and much more of a belief that there's an institutional crisis happening, linked partly to weak leadership in the Commission, partly to the disruptive behaviour of a European Parliament that, although directly elected, had no new powers and was expressing its disapproval of this by frustrating the annual budgetary negotiations, and thirdly by the frequent blockage at the Council of Ministers level due to the lack of qualified majority voting. And a lot of the push that will lead to the Single European Act comes from the belief that you have to address certainly the European Parliament power issue and the qualified majority voting power as part of any move to move Europe forward, whereas the British sort of go on until the first stages of the IGC, maintaining that Europe can be fixed without touching the institutions. And it does strike me that that's a fairly profound difference of opinion, which is perhaps temporarily bridged by the Single European Act, but is important for the period ahead as well as for the period that this book covers.
I mean, I should have said actually, there's a lot of frustration with the activities of the European Parliament at various stages, trying to use their votes as a lever over the rebate. Yeah. But that engagement is about dealing with the Parliament as a nuisance. I think seeing the Parliament as
as I think British governments have done in more recent times, as an instrument that you can use positively rather than see it as a negative factor. That wasn't around at the time. I mean, Margaret Thatcher's frustration, with Roy Jenkins, why hasn't he been more helpful, as if that was kind of his role, because he's a Brit. Piers' book about Roy Jenkins brings this out very clearly, very much mirrored by Roy Jenkins' frustration with British policy. And if you read the official accounts of meetings between Margaret Thatcher and Roy Jenkins and compare them with Roy Jenkins' own diary accounts, you get a very different impression from both those sides. And there's a lot of stuff about her frustration with Christopher Tugendhat, who is, of course, a Conservative appointee to the European Commission. And Tugendhat, at the end of his term, writes a rather a well-argued but rather plaintive account of the duties of a European Commissioner to try and instill in her what the independent role of a European Commissioner should be. Of course, there's no sign that this is received with anything other than complete contempt.
Okay, well, that's a good note to end on. We started a few minutes late, so we're going to finish a few minutes late. Now, one or two, just to round up, really. I think, first, it's excellent that we've been able to hear from Stephen and our two respondents this evening about this excellent, nuanced study of what is a most important period in our understanding, or our need for understanding, of the history of the UK's relationship with the European Union. For myself, I've heard a number of things this evening which just remind me about the importance of people, Callaghan and Thatcher and many of the other people involved, about this endless struggle the British have of knowing whether they're part of Europe, have a special relationship with the United States, or still wedded to the Commonwealth, and perhaps the decline of the third of those, and also about the importance and power of diplomats and diplomacy in managing, I use the word carefully, politicians, for all our benefit. Anyway, I'd like to thank Lindsay, Piers, and particularly Stephen Wall for their excellent presentations tonight. And I would two other things to say. One is the book will be available for sale outside as you leave. And as you leave, if you'd like to make a donation for the International Epilepsy Day charity, can you give it to Jill Bennett? Does it say not many envelopes? Is that what it says here? Not enough envelopes. Well, if you'd like to, you'll be up at the back. So that's Jill. Other than that, thank you for coming, and thank you.
Thank you.